I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Dude, that's what wakes you up in the morning?
It's okay. Not an alarm.
Well, hold on. It gets louder.
It's a progressive
this
thing.
This is just going to give you inception. This is not going to wake you up. This is going to change the course of your dream so that you're dreaming in some sort of like concrete, you know, shit city. And then all of a sudden it turns, you end up in like Morocco.
Yeah, agreed. You need to get like a siren kind of alarm going on.
So that actually does do that some mornings, Jer. But most mornings it's fine. But
do you want to know what I wake up
to? Last night, I put my phone.
This is what I wake up to. And I'm like,
I'm being mocked by somebody.
It's time to wake up and own the day.
Yeah.
So when I have like a hard wake up in the morning and I can't snooze, I usually will put my phone on the other side of the room so that I have to get up and go get it to turn it off. And I forgot that I had that setting on my phone, so it just did not wake me up at all.
Of course, it didn't wake you up, dude.
It wakes me up most mornings.
That is the
by most mornings. I mean every morning except for today.
That is the sound version of someone just lightly massaging the bottom of your feet while somebody else.
That's why
is
I
just
like
stroking
it.
Your temple.
That's why I like it.
And somebody else is just blowing into your. Into your the side of your neck.
This is the this is usually what I wake up to.
Dogs barking at you?
Are you trying to tell us that you just got a dog?
No, that's just my alarm.
For real?
Your alarm is dogs barking? That's a really
I feel like
bark.
That'll also just fuck your dreams up.
Yeah.
Molly, what do you wake up to?
I wake up to dogs barking as well, but it's just my dog actually barking because he needs to be.
That's a great alarm.
Yeah, I don't own a dog yet, so
that's kind of sad.
The reason we're talking about all this bullshit is because we were supposed to record at a certain time today, which we are. We're kind of on time, but we had a whole like meeting planned beforehand, and Taylor slept through all of it.
Yeah, I miss it. And then I woke up with that feeling like Brian came into my apartment and was like, yo, what the fuck? And I woke up at that moment. And you know, when you wake up really suddenly, I was very, very flustered and like heavy morning fog and was like, oh, fuck.
It was like,
fuck. And then I got my shit on. I had to go take Loki out and I got in the car and I was like, how am I going to sit and talk?
Well, you're sitting and talking now.
I know.
And today, our guest is Molly, and we're going to talk about breast cancer. Did that wake you up a little?
The fog is lifted.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Did you get some coffee at least?
No, I didn't.
Oh.
No, it's a major issue. But you know what? I think that this will lift me right up.
I think the worst part was that when we walked in here, Jer was like, oh yeah, don't worry, Tay. I put the coffee on. The coffee's running and there's just no coffee machine here.
Yeah, we don't have coffee.
I was still in a bit of a morning fog at that point, and I know that we don't have a coffee machine in here, but I still went, oh. And then my second thought was, you bought a coffee machine?
And then your third thought was, no, you're an asshole.
Molly, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We actually are going to talk about breast cancer, but you're super young.
Yeah, I am super young.
And I feel like you might have gotten this before. Aren't you a little young for breast cancer?
So, yes, I am, absolutely. I was 29 when I was diagnosed. I'm 30 now. So, like, I'm a decade younger than women start to get mammograms. Like, it's not even something that women my age are screened for.
Oh, really?
It is a lot more common than people realize, I've learned, like, having gone through this experience.
Mm-hmm. I said that in, like, a cheeky manner.
Yeah.
Because we know, already know this.
Yes.
I'm sure that someone heard that and they were like, you fucking asshole. Yeah. Why would you say it like that? Mm-hmm. We know that people... Cancer doesn't really discriminate.
Didn't we? Wasn't the episode that we did on breast cancer? You sat down. You sat down and talked to a woman named Molly in Hawaii, right?
In Maui.
Yeah,
Molly from Maui.
So
is there a connection there?
Statistically, like, if your name is Molly, are you more likely to develop breast cancer?
I mean, the stats don't lie.
Right, right. So it's your parents' fault? Is that what we're saying then? It's because your parents named you Molly?
That's what I'm hearing.
Heard it here, folks. We're giving you the goods. Only the
groundbreaking research.
That's right. That's right. Cancer doesn't discriminate. It doesn't, you know, for the most part. You can be any age and get cancer.
Absolutely.
Although statistically, it's a little bit more rare for your age.
Yeah. Group. So for my age group, specifically with breast cancer, like, that is definitely known to probably the over 40 crowd. Mm. But it does happen for younger women, and it's also it's a different disease. It really is. Like, for young women, like I said, we don't get screened. We don't get regular mammograms. So one, we're not looking for it. And two, it tends to be much more aggressive. So
if you get it when you're younger?
Yeah, it tends to be a more aggressive form of the disease.
Why is that? Do we know? Or do you know?
I don't know.
Interesting. No.
Is that part of, like, what the docs tell you when like, if you are a younger case of breast cancer? Are they going, well, these are sort of the things that we see in younger cases of breast cancer?
Yeah.
I'm curious. You mentioned that, like, you're 10 years younger than when people usually start getting mammograms. Then how did you detect that you had breast cancer? Like, let's go kind of, I guess, from the start of your experience.
Yeah.
Like, what was it that was a sign for you?
So my experience is a little bit unique. I found the lump myself, but the only reason that I did find it is because it hurt. So seemingly out of nowhere, one day I had this shooting pain in my left breast. And I initially thought, like, maybe my bra was too tight. Like, I kind of ran up to my room to take my bra off, and expected to get that kind of, like, sense of relief. And that didn't happen. And I kind of instinctively put my hand where the pain was, and it, like, there it was. Like, it was just...
You just felt a lump.
It was a lump, like, clear as day. Out of nowhere.
Is it one of those things that you go, that you touch That's and you crazy. Go, how did I not
absolutely.
Feel that before?
Yeah, like, absolutely. And so I wasn't, you know, we're women, I don't know what the age is, but I should have been doing regular self-exams, and I wasn't. And I think probably most women my age aren't.
Mm. Is that, do you, so I know that mammograms don't come till later, but do they encourage... self-examination
I think
to happen, like,
so.
Early?
I remember probably when I was a teenager, like, going to the doctor to get birth control for the first time, and my doctor did a breast exam and said, you know, this is something that you should do to yourself regularly. And I, like, kind of in one ear, out the other, never thought about it again.
Yeah.
But there it was. And so I've thought a lot since then about, like, you know, had I been checking, would I have found it earlier? And, you know, could I have caught it at an earlier stage and maybe saved myself from going through some treatment? And honestly, I don't think that was the case for me. Like, I think it was kind of hiding and, like, rolled up against a nerve.
Mm.
And that's why I had the pain.
Which is why it felt like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Isn't that such a jarring thing? Like, I don't know about you guys. Like, do you guys, like, inspect? Do you inspect your bodies much?
Yeah,
like,
I do. Well,
there's a fair bit of inspection going on.
I worked a little bit 3 or 4 years ago with an organization called Ballsy.
Yeah,
which
right.
Is a, like, testicular cancer, and one of the campaigns that we were working on, like, 4 years ago was promoting men to self inspect.
Yeah,
So like, I think that I kind of, that probably was a bit of an impetus for me to like do some self exams on myself, but I think it's something that's really important.
Yeah. I see. I find I examine myself in this like almost like primitive.
Were you talking specifically
way?
About like
anything,
like testicles,
testicle
or like,
for sure. But like, okay. But also just kind of like anywhere else. Like, I feel like if I'm watching a movie or something, it's going to sound weird. If I'm watching a movie,
yeah,
and
I know.
Whether I'm by myself or not, I'll just like, just be fondling my balls, but not like, not excitedly fondling. It's literally just like robotically fondling. And then I'll start doing that with like my like throat.
Just take the hand that was all over your balls. You just put it up on your throat and then rub your throat.
The inside
and then,
of my mouth.
he's like, gross. I wonder if I have any cavities.
But I do like, I'll sit on my hands. Like I'm constantly like palpating my body. I am fidgeting a lot. Yeah. But I constantly am like kind of examining, but I've also, I find that most times we've talked to someone when they find something going on in their body, it's because there was some sort of, trigger, which for years there was this pain, this like searing pain that kind of came out of nowhere. For Brandon, it was like, you know, he dropped that weight on his thigh and his thigh started to hurt.
I think we all kind of have those things. Like, I mean, how many times have you had a fucking pimple that's been, that like you touch and you go, how the fuck?
Where did that come from?
Did that get like that?
Yeah, yeah.
Without
me
noticing.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
But it's like you look at, I mean, that happens to me on my back all the time. But it's like I fucking look at my back every day. How did you get there?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
It is interesting. I want to throw this. So I was asking like, how often should you examine your breasts? I think this is just important to throw it there for anybody who's listening right now, specifically anyone who has breasts. According to WebMD, which is pretty legit.
Super legit.
You should have a clinical breast exam every 1 to 3 years, starting at age 20, and every year starting at age 40.
Mm. Oh, right. But I'm not a woman, so I haven't really digested that information like fully. But when you said that you don't start until you're 40, I was like, yeah, that sounds like what I've heard. Mm-hmm. Like that's the info that
mammograms?
Yeah. Mammograms, right.
When I hear the word mammogram, I always think of like animal crackers because it just makes me think mammal.
Mm-hmm.
Mammogram.
Yeah.
Like
I think that's the etymology of it.
Yeah. And then I just think,
are you serious right now?
And then I think, man, how good are animal crackers? Right?
Brian's been meaning to get a mammogram for years, but he just keeps going to the grocery store and buying animal crackers instead.
I'm here for some mammograms. They're like aisle 4, I think. I don't know. Do you think he knows what he's talking about?
Those are in the cookie aisle, I think.
So you get this searing pain.
The best part is that you're always going to think of mammogram now.
That's not the best part. That's the worst part. Do you go straight to the doctor? Or like what's your...
So I'm standing in my bedroom. I'm home alone. I'm topless at this point. I'm holding my boob in one hand and like got my phone out, hitting Google on with my other hand.
Siri.
Pretty much, yeah. So I'm Googling like painful lump in breast. And breast cancer is obviously the first thing that goes through my mind. Mm-hmm. But the internet was actually surprisingly good at convincing me that one, breast cancer didn't hurt, and two, that I was statistically speaking too young to get it.
Mm.
So that kind of like, I didn't really think too much about cancer after that point. So I'm like, okay, well, what else could this be?
Do you think that was a good thing? Do you think it was good that you didn't, you know, like if we inverse that and the internet was like, you're fucked. Cancer. Do you think from that moment until the actual diagnosis might have been worse?
Maybe a little bit. It was pretty quick, like the process. So it might have saved me like, you know.
A day of stress.
Did you go to the doctor right away?
Yeah. So I actually went to Emerge because I was like, if it's not cancer, like if it's probably not cancer, like I don't know if I maybe thought it was like a cyst that was going to explode. Like it came on with such a vengeance that I was like, if this gets worse, like I'm going to pass out. So My fiance like pulled into the driveway and I was like, feel this. I think I need to go to the doctor. It was like a Thursday night. I knew I wasn't going to be able to get into my doctor for like a week. And I just was like, I need to have this addressed right now. So we went to Emerge. And you know, when you go to Emerge and you can kind of tell like how fucked you are based on who you're sitting with. Like they put me with like the sprained ankles and like, so I was like, okay, so this is probably not a huge deal.
Mm-hmm. And then right beside you, a dude sits down with a machete sticking out of his skull and you're like,
wait,
am I okay?
Am I in that group or am I in this group?
Yeah.
He just sits down and goes, excuse me, ma'am. Calmly sits with a drop of blood.
He's like, yeah, this looks way worse than it actually is. Where was the lump?
It was on my left breast, like on the lower outer.
Like it's
quadrant.
More like it's more like armpit-y, sort of. Like is it more in that direction?
Yep.
Because I've heard like Kyla said this to me the other day. She was like, she said something about like mammograms and like, you know, when you're like sexually active, you're not like you are kind of. You're not really performing mammograms like they're supposed to be done, but like you're still like.
Are you saying you're the one who's doing the examination? Is that what you're like getting?
No, she was making like a she said something about that. Like she made some comment, and then she said to me, "This is like fucking a week ago." And she goes, "Yeah, but actually, usually I think that it happens more like on the inside and more like the armpit, where like you would not really be." Like touching if you were like being sexual, you know?
This is cool. Look at this. This is the breast self-exam patterns. So it's three different images of one breast and one. So it's like three fingers, one pattern's going down, stroking down from like top of the breast down. And then the next finger up from the bottom of the breast up in the middle. And then to the other side down again. And then there's one where it's like a star of all the fingers pushing in towards the nipple, like all meeting at the center. And then the other one is like circular motions around. Like
rotational.
Yeah.
This kind of seems like, to me, it would be like mowing the lawn, you know? Like you just want to make sure you cover the...
Make sure you get every...
You don't want to leave any patches that are...
Right, but if,
it's a good analogy.
You know? If you go around and you look and you watch like several soccer games around the world, you notice that the pitch is mowed in different ways and different pitches.
Yeah.
So because there's, you know, there's different methods and different ways to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's exactly like that.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah.
So you're at the ER sitting next to the man with the machete in his head.
Yep.
And you're thinking to yourself like, okay, this isn't.
I was in a lot of pain at that point, but realizing or starting to convince myself that it was probably not as big of a deal.
Right.
And then. Probably sat there for a couple of hours, got in to see a doctor. She had a good feel, and she's like, and she looks at me and goes, well, it's not normal. Mm. And she's like, it's probably nothing, but you're 29. You shouldn't have to deal with this. I'm going to make a call and see if I can get you in for imaging, like, ASAP. And so she goes away. She comes back. She's like, okay, just talk to the breast clinic, like, at the IWK. They're going to call you tomorrow and they're going to squeeze you in for a mammogram.
At the IWK?
Yeah. So the like there's like a women's building there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like the breast clinic in Halifax.
Sure, sure.
So I went home, tried to ignore the pain, went for my first ever mammogram at the age of 29 the following day. And that shit hurts anyway.
Oh,
but
yeah.
When you have a tumor sticking out of your side that machine is squeezing you. Like,
so what happens in a mammogram? Like, is it like a hydraulic piston thing that just crushes your.
Shaped like a giraffe or is it more like
a lion? I'll paint you a picture. Like, you know, when you go to the dentist and you get x-rays done, and you have to like go right up to that thing and bite down and the thing goes around you. So you kind of like. You walk up to this machine, like place your boob on a surface, and then it like you get a couple of pictures where it comes from like top to bottom and squeezes you. And it's like it's just like it's so forceful that like you think, oh my God, I can't possibly take this for another second. And then it releases. And then it goes like
sideways.
Side to side. So it's just awful. And so I'm sitting there, like I'm in so much pain. I'm with this like woman who's like an x-ray technician, like tits out. Like I'm just like, so how did you get into this line of work? Like,
and she's trying to make you comfortable. So yeah. Like her tits are out. She's like, it's all good. Yeah. You know, like she's got
straight. It was line. A tits out party. Yeah. No. So it's like, it was just so uncomfortable. Like
it's fucking 2019 now. Like, yeah. and this was 2017. Like,
yeah,
I mean, it is like we're in the future. We live in the future.
Yeah.
You know, Black Mirror is here. Why are we squishing tits still? Why, like, why can't we just?
Yeah.
Well, it used to be somebody doing it with their hands.
I know, dude, but where's the, like, why do we gotta squish it?
Yeah.
Like, if
there must be a reason for it.
No, there isn't. If you can go in for what's it called? A CT scan? An MRI. Come on, they can layer your brain,
right?
And you just sit there, and there's this giant thing.
But that's the next. Yeah. I'm assuming that's the next. That's a step further.
Yeah, so it is.
They're not going to issue an MRI or a CT scan.
No,
doing that.
Right, but what I'm saying is, why don't we have that sort of version of the mammogram, like? Just at some sort of like X-ray,
like a GoPro.
Why do we have to squish it? Why do we have to take the breast
because
and just?
I don't know if I'm comfortable. I don't know if I'm comfortable, like trying to shout down the medical technology industry. Right
I am comfortable with it. Let's start a revolution right here. This is it.
somebody posted a meme yesterday, and it was like. We live in a world where I'm confusing my robot assistants, like Siri and Alexa.
I saw that.
It is fucking true. Well, I mean, I'm sure, dude.
I'm looking it up right now. Why?
It replaces the hands, and they obviously do a better job if it's done with a machine. I mean, like all things.
I think because
one of the reasons for compressing the breast is to hold it away from the chest wall. Okay. All right.
Sure. Yeah.
Sure. Another reason is that the thinner you can make anything you are x-raying, the lower the dose that you'll need to use. So by thinning the breast, we can use a lower x-ray dose. Okay, that's also probably a good thing.
So a mammogram's-
In addition, just as any picture you take, if the breast moves during the study, then blurring will make it impossible to see small details. So the compression holds the breast still. Man, I don't know.
There's a lot of good reasons there, Jared.
There are. Yeah, I guess
But
so.
You know what? I don't agree with it.
Yeah, that's right.
We need a new machine.
I just feel like it's like, you know, you're taking photos. Why does it have to be so painful?
Imagine if we had a mammogram machine like that for our balls. That's why you're so
privileged
concerned.
To be if fucking
that's
male.
How... balls were examined, new science immediately.
You're goddamn right there would be.
You're goddamn right there would be.
It's funny because that machine would last for like one day and it was like back in the medieval days.
Getting mad about the mammogram process is like, why do you have to stick a needle in a bone to get bone marrow? Why can't you just teleport it out of there? It's like, that's like
2019.
That's the way you got to do it.
I mean, if I can make my home smart, I just feel like we can.
If I can turn my lights on with my voice, we should have to squish boobs.
So anyway, Molly.
Tits were out. They were squishing your boobs. Like the technician, she was getting crazy. Like things were heating up. Okay.
So, you know, it's kind of a funny process because like I went to Emerge. They told me I needed to get a mammogram, got the mammogram. And then I go to my doctor's office to like get the mammogram results. And he's got this letter that says, like, yeah, there's a lump. And I'm like, are you fucking serious? Like, I know there's a lump. Like, we don't have any new information now. Like, why did I deal with that? So then they're like, well, now you need a biopsy. So I go back to the breast clinic, have a biopsy. That's basically like you're laying down and you get a mammogram and they stab you with a needle a bunch of times.
Oh, fuck.
Like the plus version.
So then I'm having, and it's a doctor that does that procedure. And so at this point, I'm starting to get scared. Like, I'm like, okay, this is something.
Breast cancer's creeping back
It's creeping back in. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm used to doctors who like don't want to give you information. Like they don't want to tell you results until everything's like in and you know.
You're used to that?
Well, I feel like that's like the standard experience.
What's
like,
what's your doctor experience before this? Are you somebody who like, you know, goes to the hospital or goes to the doctor like every once in a while, never goes?
Yeah. I mean, I've had some other like health issues in my life. Like I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease when I was younger. And so I've been through the process of like getting blood work and like all that stuff. And I just, like, in my mind, I was like, this guy's not going to say he thinks it's cancer, so I'm trying to trick him. Like, I'm trying to say, like, okay, so...
You're trying to pull it out.
Am I going to need to have surgery? Because if I'm going to need to have surgery, I need to take some time off from work. And, like, I, you know, it'd be good if I could plan that. Like, I'm trying to, like...
If I had something, would it rhyme with Francer?
Yeah. And so, like, again...
No, you have cancer.
We're having this conversation... Tits out. Yeah. This time I'm bleeding. And I'm just like, I need to take some time off work. Like, you need to tell me some information. But I honestly think, like, and he was just like, yeah, you're going to have surgery. Like, there's no, there was no hesitation. And I, looking back, and like, if I had have just asked him, do you think this is cancer? I think he would have said 100% yes. Yeah, yes. Right. So sure enough, a couple days later, got the call from my family doctor, and so that was like a Friday before the long weekend. And I was freaking out at that point because I was like, if I don't get these results now, he's going to make me come in next week. Like, I'm going to be freaking out all weekend. But he actually gave me the results over the phone, which is super surprising. But I'm very grateful that he didn't make me sweat it out.
And this is all pretty quick.
Yeah, it was like maybe 10 days, like from like found the lump to diagnosis.
So now when you found out, were they like, this is, did they give you like stages or like what was the severity when they told you?
Yeah, so my family doctor didn't have a whole lot of insight, which is really frustrating because I'm like, you hear cancer and you're like, okay, like you got a million questions.
Yeah,
and she's like,
racing.
I'm not an oncologist. Like this isn't. I'm not the person to give you this information.
But he said on the phone, like, he said on the phone, you have breast cancer.
Yeah, he said, no, he said there were malignant cells in your sample.
I feel like it, with our experience, they never say cancer.
I think it was Matt Amiot that said
and
that.
So I had, a couple of days later, I had to start kind of like telling people. And so I told one of my good friends, I was like, hey, remember that lump that like I told you I was like getting checked out? Like, it turns out like there were malignant cells. And she was like, okay, I have a really stupid question. Like, do you have breast cancer? And I was like, I don't know. Like, is that like where I'm at right now?
Did anybody along your like entire experience, doctor wise in the medical field, do they say breast cancer at any point?
Yeah. So after I got my diagnosis, I was referred like immediately to a breast surgeon. And that was like kind of a kick in the stomach. Like that was the first doctor who was, he knew the process and he kind of told me very bluntly and not very compassionately, like what the next like 9 months of my life were going to look like. So he was like, yeah, you're going to have surgery. And I was like, what about like other, like, am I going to need other treatment? And he looked at me and he said, you're going to have surgery. You're going to have chemo. You're going to have radiation and you're going to have hormone therapy. And I was like, it was like head in hands. Like I just like had such a explosive meltdown. Like, and my big concerns were fertility. I was 29. I had just got engaged like 2 weeks earlier. So we're very much like at that stage of our lives where like we're looking to get married and start a family. And like, it was a 10-minute conversation, and in the span of that 10 minutes, like, everything I had been looking forward to was ripped right out of my hands. Yeah. Like, I get emotional thinking about it now. Like, it was so intense.
What are the fertility options at that point? Like, are they like, before we do this, we're going to freeze your...
Yeah, so that's an option. He said chemo would kind of shut my ovaries down, basically. And
like permanently or like
no,
temporarily?
So he, the way that he worded it, I interpreted it as permanently, but later down the road, my actual medical oncologist was like, no, like you'll probably be okay. Like it'll probably come back at some point. But yeah, he was like, he's like freezing your eggs is an option, but it would delay treatment. It would cost $20,000.
Yeah, it's not cheap. Yeah.
And actually, so we seriously considered it, but you guys had done an episode with a woman who was going through fertility treatment or had gone through fertility treatment here in Halifax, and it, like the timing of it was like right while this was going on, and we both kind of listened to that episode as like an intel into the whole process of what we would be in for if we did go down that path, and so that was great.
Just curious, did you glean anything from that, or were you like, what are these fucking idiots talking about? You know what I mean? Like,
no,
did you actually
from
take
the episode?
Something?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you didn't take any medical advice, right?
No,
not for you specifically.
No, just what the
journey of
the
what
journey
that was like.
And yeah. You know, it's not a guarantee, and the financial implications of it all. So it costs like $20,000. Like,
yeah, it's no joke.
And it was something that we would have had to have decided, like,
in a couple
pretty
of days.
Quickly, yeah. Right? And it would delay treatment, and they pump you full of hormones, which in my case were feeding my cancer. Mm. So it was like it was risky, and we ultimately decided not to go down that path. And I think that was probably the right decision for us. Yeah.
When people get diagnosed with cancer, I imagine if I was to be diagnosed with cancer, like the main question I would have right away is like, is this going to kill me? Is the thing that I wonder about. And it sounds like the fertility issue was a big cause for concern for you. But like, how did that balance in comparison to like wondering if you were going to be okay?
Mm. Yeah. I don't know that I ever really allowed myself to consider that this might kill me. Like, I'm very much not that kind of person. Like, I'm like the opposite of a hypochondriac. I'm like, it's probably fine. Like, everything. Like, I definitely, in my mind, was downplaying it. I do remember, like, my surgeon was talking about, like, I only had a lumpectomy. I didn't have a mastectomy where they actually remove your breast. They just were able to go in and take out the tumor.
Did they get lazy with the word lumpectomy? Because, mastectomy, if you said mastectomy to somebody who has
never
heard of it.
That's like a highly scientific sounding term.
Oh, if you had no clue, you'd go, what's that? Lumpectomy, it's like,
yeah.
They took out the lump.
Yeah.
They just got so lazy
like,
with it.
Lump, not even tumor. Like, it's a lump.
Yeah, it's a tumorectomy. They were like, that sounds too silly. Let's call it lumpectomy.
So when my surgeon was explaining, you know, he didn't want to cut more than he needed to. He didn't want to put me through, like, a bigger surgery. And he was explaining that it wasn't going to impact survival. And I remember being like, why is he saying survival? Like, I'm not going to die. Like, what?
Such
like,
a primitive word to use. I mean, like, not that he shouldn't use it, but I mean, like, it's just, that's such a...
What did he mean by it's not going to impact survival?
Like, so whether I had a mastectomy versus a lumpectomy, it wouldn't...
It's not going to make any difference, like, whether or not you may or may not die?
You're right. It won't.
Correct.
Okay.
It won't make it any greater or any worse.
Christ. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was... probably the first time that it occurred to me that other people were thinking that maybe this would be bad.
How intense was the, I'm kind of fascinated by the maternal instinct in terms of, you know, having that thought process around eggs and, you know, trying to go through that whole process. And just more so because, you know, everybody's different.
Yeah.
You know, some women don't want children, some women do, some men don't want children, some men do. I find that when we talk to people who become sick, and probably because you're carrying, women carry all the reproductive, you know, organs that are going to like see through the birth, that there's just like such an instinct,
yeah,
to have that concern. Like it's one, it, mm-hmm, it, several times when we've spoken to people, it's one of those like first concerns. And I don't know if I've ever heard that be brought up by a man, like really quickly. Like that was one of the first thoughts that they had. Like,
yeah,
what about kids?
What about kids? Like, especially, we've talked to lots of guys with cancer and very rarely an issue. Whereas chemo, I'm assuming, I'm making a pretty broad stroke assumption that chemo is going to affect like the production of your sperm, or a bunch of medications like you take. Is your infertility because of medication or is it because of the CF?
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But like, it's just not something that you hear nearly as much. I'm just kind of like, I find it really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I don't think in general men have that like maternal instinct.
Like biologically, you think it's just far less of a thing.
I think it's more akin to women. Really naturally, I think.
I think for us, it was the biggest part was just the stage of life that we were at. Like we were very much,
and that's like a part of the conversation. Yeah. Like you're just
right there,
engaged. Yeah. Like you're like excited about the future of like, you know, we're gonna settle down. We're maybe gonna get home together.
Yeah.
All of that stuff is like you think on the surface.
I think if it had been my fiance who was in the cancer seat. I think he probably would have had similar concerns.
But if you,
I don't know if they would have been as intense. Like,
right. Say something comes around in your early 20s. That's probably not the thought that.
Yeah. If I had been 22, I would have been like, oh shit, I'm going to lose my hair. My boobs. Yeah. What?
Sick Boy Podcast. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Jesse Cruikshank.
Jesse Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
Speaking of losing the hair.
Yeah, so I did.
You did. Okay. Yeah. Because your hair right now, people can't see, is very short.
Yeah.
It's longer than mine.
It's much longer than mine.
It's shorter than mine, I think. Did you lose it all? Like, what was the.
Yeah.
And that's from the
chemo,
right?
Okay. Yeah. So I had my surgery in August. Then I was referred on to a medical oncologist. And so I started chemo around like the end of October. I had my first chemo treatment. And then so your hair doesn't fall out right away. Mm. So I had my first treatment. I was on like a 3-week cycle. So I would go like every 21 days and get an infusion. And the first few days were definitely the hardest. So I had kind of like just picked myself up off the floor and I'm starting to think like, okay, like 5 more rounds of this, like I can do this. Like I know what I'm in for. Like I can handle this. And then my scalp starts tingling and it like, I knew it was going to happen, but nothing can prepare you for that.
And at that point, like from the tingling, that's actually really interesting. I've never heard anyone say they had a physical sensation.
Yeah.
Was it pretty quick? Like, was your hair just coming out in clumps? Or?
Kind of. Like, so it started like heavy shedding. Mm. And then it's like, you know, you're having a shower and you're just like,
pulling it out.
It fucked with you pretty bad? Yeah, it did. And like, I was prepared, like I had gone and like purchased a wig. Like this was a big thing for me. I was really self-conscious about losing my hair. So I had a wig lined up and it looked like very similar to my hair. Like a lot of people probably wouldn't have noticed the difference. So as soon as it started tingling, like a couple days later, I went and like had it shaved off.
Oh, you wasted no time. You're just like,
like some people can get through like a few rounds of treatment before their hair totally falls out. Like I think like you start shedding But then it would kind of stop until you have your next treatment, and then it would start again. So some people let it thin out, and I don't.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a personal choice. Yeah. To me, it was just like.
Did your eyebrows start to come out?
So my eyebrows didn't come out until toward the very end of chemo. So after the first couple of rounds, like I've got a wig, like I'm feeling okay. I still kind of look like myself. But by the end, like I was just so haggard looking. Like I lost my eyebrows. I remember one night I was actually like getting ready to like meet some friends for dinner. And I went to put on mascara and I was like, oh, I don't have eyelashes anymore. No. Like it was because I was like,
did you just mascara them off? Like, you know, because like that.
No, like
brush
I went to go. I went to go put it on and they just weren't there. Yeah.
Whoa. Isn't it crazy how.
Isn't it crazy how you wouldn't notice that your eyelashes come out? Because you can't really see them.
But you have eyelashes now. And I always heard that like if you pull your eyelashes out, then they don't grow back.
Oh,
I knew a girl in high school.
Whoa, hold on.
Because
you don't know. You made that up.
No, I didn't make that up.
I went to high school with
Jeremy.
A girl I went to high school with pulled out her eyelashes and they never grew back. However, I just Googled it. Will your eyelashes grow back if pulled out from the root? Yes.
It actually specifically says Brian's wrong.
And Brian Stever is wrong.
I think I was right. If you just said if you pull them out from the root, then they don't grow back?
No, they do. Okay. Yeah, they just have a normal growth cycle.
And I didn't say that I was saying that. I said I heard that.
No, you said you said it. You said anyway. That you came up with that. So
which I was surprised when you, because you have lovely eyelashes.
Thank
now.
Thank you.
And that's literally
the nicest thing you guys could say to me.
You do. When Brian said that, I was like, they could be, they look great, but they also look so good that they could be.
Do you want to hear something kind of fucked up?
Yeah, definitely.
So
the more fucked up, the better on this show,
so obviously, like, my eyebrows and my eyelashes have grown back, and, you know, the hair on my head is growing back. Eyebrows and eyelashes are kind of on, like, cycles.
Yeah,
so when you lose
here.
Your eyelashes and they all start to grow back at the same time, they, like, fall out again.
Whoa.
So, like, my eyelashes have, like, grown back and thinned. Like, I haven't lost them all, but they've, like, grown and fallen out and grown
Whoa,
and fallen
wow,
out, like, a couple times. Yeah.
Crazy.
And it's super common.
So, like, you've entered this, like, sort of, like, butterfly cocoon effect of, like, going through.
Yeah.
They just come and die, and then they come and die.
Yeah, so it can take, like, I think it takes about a year for them to, like, get on different growth cycles.
Oh.
So it's enough that, like, you don't notice it when they fall out.
Oh, because they need to be staggered in their, like, life cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Isn't it crazy how... I mean, and I know that we all share this attachment, even though, Jerry, you don't have long hair, but Brian and I had, like, really long hair, and we've cut it several times, and that, like, how attached you are to your hair, even though it really serves this, like, it serves this very social purpose,
yeah.
but, like, really no, like, actual purpose in terms of, like, being on our head, like it did at one time, like, evolutionarily, but, like, how attached you are when you go to cut your hair or when you're going to lose your hair, like that, how intense that is. And the last time when Jer shaved my head, like just a few weeks ago, and I've had hair down on my nipples for like basically 10 years. And like that feeling right before you're about to make that first cut is like, dude, my heart is going through.
Yeah, you were like, you had to psych yourself up.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's just wild how we have that reaction to our hair.
But the reason why is because it kind of becomes part of like your personal style and like it's something that you wear, like you wear clothes, but like when you change it so drastically, it really changes like the way that you look and present yourself over to other people. And like I think that there is like this message that it almost sends. Like when I was getting to the end of my time, I lived in Dubai for 4 years. And when I first started working there, I had like a very clean cut. And then like the last kind of year leading up to the time that I was leaving, I started to let my hair grow.
You really did.
And like probably like 3 or 4 months after not cutting my hair, like some people in my office started to make comments like, you know, like you should probably cut your hair. You should probably clean it up a little bit. But it was almost like I had done like a yoga teacher training like the year before and stuff, and was just kind of like
he was actualizing
in this mindset of like, I was almost like, this is my like kind of subtle fuck you to the corporate world. You know, like I'm gonna do my thing. Yeah. This is me, and like and I had long hair like before I had started that job, so it was like almost going back to like the way that I lived my life before.
Yeah.
I got into that. So like I can understand why there's like such an attachment to something that really does serve no purpose.
How do you feel about your hair now, having gone through the process of letting it go? Because I know that once I, as soon as it was done shaving my head for like a few weeks ago, I went, oh, I'm fine now. Like, did you have like, was it all build up and then like no substance afterwards?
No, or did it was kind of the opposite. I think when I was in treatment, it was kind of like a practicality. Like, it was like, okay, I'm sick right now. I lose my hair. Like, that's just the cost of getting better. Mm-hmm. Afterward, I struggled with it a lot more. I finished chemo at the beginning of February. My hair didn't actually really start to grow back until May.
Whoa, that's a long time.
And so, like, I had radiation at that point. Like, my body was still, like, being pretty beat up. Mm. But it took a while for it to start growing back. And it just, like, it's part of your, like you said, it's, like, part of your personal identity.
Yeah.
Hair, I mean, it's a very...
it's a core identity.
It's a very, like, transformative thing.
I struggled with it so much, though, because it's, like, it's wearing your illness on your fucking head.
You can no longer say you're having like, you know, you have that invisible illness. Like, it is, and also it is a fucking tattoo on your forehead
exactly.
of like cancer.
Yeah.
You know, like it is very obvious when someone has
and
cancer.
And people will ask you about it. So at this point, like when my hair starts to grow back, like wearing a wig is kind of uncomfortable. It's summertime now, it's getting hot, like it's not gonna work. So I ditch the wig and just start rocking short hair.
I've worked with a lot of cancer patients through this organization that I used to work for where they ran camps. We'll talk after.
Okay.
I think you should probably hit them up.
Okay.
It's for young adults and it's like a surf camp in Maui. And they all come and we all hang out and we all just talk about, you know, what their cancer experience is like. And a lot of them all, you know, have it always ends up with this like sort of jovial, jokey, laughy sort of comparison conversation about like, what was it like when your hair came back? What was it like when your hair came back? And a lot of, I didn't know this until I started working with the camp, but a lot of people, their hair comes back
different,
completely different than what their hair used to be.
Chemo curls are a thing.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And did you have it in like weird places? Because I've heard of like people that where they go, the sides of my head came out curly. The top came out straight.
Oh, crazy.
Or like the back came out curly. Like they just start growing this mullet. Like, like back curly.
That's crazy. I'm in like mullet territory right now. It's really stressful.
Your hair's shorter, but it's kind of like it's wavy.
It's wavy.
It's got some waves. My hair before was like pin straight. Really? I've heard of it coming back in like different colors too, but I think this is pretty close to my natural color. Cool. So,
You mentioned a couple times about your experience with other people and other people's perceptions. I think earlier on when we were talking about when the doctor brought up the word survival, it was almost like you were alluding to the fact that other people were maybe wondering about whether or not you would die. Is that true? Was it hard to manage the experience of your loved ones?
Yes. I would say like, this was a pretty crazy experience and there were a lot of lows, but the hardest part was telling my parents that their only child had cancer. And I was so conscious of like downplaying the severity for their benefit. I spent a lot of time with them when I was actually going through chemotherapy, and it was watching them watch me go through it was by far the hardest.
Yeah. You know, it's super interesting to hear you say that because I've never, even though we've gone over conversations like this quite a bit, it's almost like you get the news, and yeah. then you in turn have to almost be that role of like the doctor who's like telling the patient yeah. Like your parents are obviously you're pretty close with your parents.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you have to go and break that news to them. Yeah. Is there like this feeling of compassion for the healthcare providers who have to go and break that news to patients, like delivering that yourself?
I mean, I've never really thought about that before, but yeah, I have a lot of appreciation, I guess, for people who can deliver that news like sensitively mm-hmm. and compassionately.
Mm-hmm. It always it's a constant sort of like reemergence of this of this idea on the show is how when you get sick, it becomes a burden of the person who's sick to like really manage the emotions.
How much effort is to take care of everyone else
and your friends
for you?
You have to speak to those people and like you said, you're downplaying the severity for their sake so that they don't freak out. And you know, it's just such a fascinating facet of being sick is managing the people in your life and how you almost you need care and you're being taken care of by people in the medical field but you also sort of become a sort of caregiver in a way with your friends and family
yeah.
and that's something that you have to manage, which I don't know, like I struggle with whether that's something that should take place and whether that creates growth and like and is overall, even though it's probably heavy and hard, is a positive thing for the people who are sick, or whether it's too much. I don't know.
I think it's really probably dependent on the person and the people involved. You know what I mean? Like it's like anything and anyone. Like there's some people that really rise to the occasion, and then there's some people that just crumble under that pressure.
Yeah.
And not just the sick person. I'm talking about like
the other people.
Anyone could be the person who's sick. I mean, I remember one time recently that I was hospitalized and in pretty rough shape for like a good 2 or 3 weeks, and I was a fucking piece of shit to be around. So much so that I specifically didn't want people coming to visit me in the hospital, because I knew, man, when they come in, they're not going to get – I'm not going to be capable of like allowing them to see that I'm okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm not okay, and I don't want to have to fucking try to like manage that. And you know, but then there's been times where – it's like, oh no, I'm the rock. I'm here. I'm gonna like make sure everyone feels good and like.
And it's, you go through, like how you feel about playing that role changes like with the weather, basically,
exactly.
Like day by
moment
day.
By moment. Yeah. Yeah.
The conversation's really multifaceted though around the illness itself. Like I know with my experience with my mom having bladder cancer, it was like her ability to talk to me about the treatment process and like the medical side of things was great. Like she was able to go through everything in detail. And like there wasn't very much that she left out of that side of the conversation. Mm-hmm. But when it came to the emotional side, like that was much more challenging for her to like open up and say, I'm not doing well. Like I need help. And then there's her emotional side. And then there's the emotional side of the people around her too. So there's lots of ways to talk about it, I think. And sometimes people feel comfortable more with one than the other and that's okay. But I think if there's better communication around the entire like idea of all of these different things, then it makes it easier to talk about.
Mm-hmm. So let's fast forward a little bit. You got the cancer in 2017.
Yep.
It's now just freshly 2019.
Yep.
How are you now? Where are you at in that journey, in that process?
I'm doing well. So it's funny. I actually just had my very last infusion right before Christmas. So it was very fitting that you called me when you did. So that was kind of that was the end of active treatment for me.
High five.
Thank you.
Right on.
Yeah, it was I had my last infusion on a Friday, and then
did you ding that bell?
I did ding the bell, yeah. And then drank so much that night. Like, it was quite the party.
Yeah. Just keep that detox. Yeah. Just keep that retox going.
Yeah, you know, and it was it was my last day of work, like before the holidays. Like, it was a really nice way to start the holiday season, and it feels great to start 2019 kind of with that behind me.
Yeah.
So that part's done. The struggle for me now is like mentally.
Yeah.
And trying to adjust to like a new normal. And, you know, I've been back to work for a while now, but it's an ongoing struggle. And I don't know. I think this is going to be a challenge for me for a long time.
Are you seeking support? Like, or have you put in research into like sort of support networks that exist for young cancer survivors?
Yeah. So I'm part of some like online communities. Being such like a rare circumstance, there's not a ton of people like locally who have gone through my experience, but there's a lot of really good communities online. And like I've done some therapy and counseling and stuff like that. So, and I have like a ton of support in my life. I have really good people around me. So,
are you in like, are you in sort of like a monitoring stage now where they're going, well, we're like every whatever it is to like month? Is it like every month and then every 3 months and then every 6 months? And like
not quite. Something? So I think that's actually a little bit of an outdated model, at least for breast cancer. So I will have like, I'll get a mammogram every year forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm supposed to get breast exams done by my family doctor, like quarterly, and then do a self-exam once a month. But in terms of like doing like 6 month scans, like that kind of thing where they look at your whole body, that's, I think the jury is still kind of out on whether that's super effective or not. Like my doctor feels like that just tends to cause more anxiety for people than it does actually like help their long-term outcomes.
So you're in the state. So where you are now is okay. We've removed the cancer. We've gone through treatment, and now like, you know, as all sits, you know, quote unquote, you're okay.
Fingers crossed.
And then you have these checkups. You have these regular check-ins to make sure that nothing's there. That you're where you need to be. Or where you want to be. So that's your place.
Guys, can we say that, like, as human beings, can we say that we've cured cancer?
No. Not at all. Not like, even remotely.
In some instances, though?
No.
But my mom doesn't have cancer.
Your mom doesn't have cancer right now.
Yeah, but cure being a word that means that that somebody can go, we've removed the chances for you to get cancer again. Like, we've taken care of it, and it won't come back.
Yeah, everybody on the planet has the chance of getting cancer. In fact, it's getting higher and higher, more likely.
Everyone on the planet, if they live long enough, will get cancer.
Yeah. So curing cancer, I think, would mean that you cannot get it.
Curing cancer would be ridding the world of cancer.
It's like, I'm going to take a vaccine for whatever, and I'm not going to get it.
Yeah, they got rid of your mom's cancer, but
it's like a cure.
Not really. I mean, I don't think so. But I mean, there's treatments, right? Mm-hmm. So like, there's that we can treat cancer, but we cannot cure it.
Kind of the same way that you know, there's that whatever. What's the drug again for CF that cures that?
Kalydeco.
Like it stops it. Like it basically, it doesn't take it away. It doesn't remove it from your body. It just like. Just treats it so it doesn't fuck with you anymore.
Yeah, slows it down.
And I don't mean to be like insensitive in saying that or anything, because I know that there's a lot of people who die from cancer at like every single day, you know? And I don't mean to be insensitive whatsoever.
No, it's a good question.
But like the thing is that
we treat it.
Right.
Does that count, is your mom cured?
Right. Yeah. Like I would say yes, but like there is a chance that
of that one round.
Yeah, yes. Right.
But every doctor would be very concerned about like the language that you use, and they would go cure? No, definitely not.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I understand in the sense that, and not to beat a dead horse, but like I understand in the sense that like cure would be eradicating like human beings of that.
It's just not the word. We treat it well, but then also depending on like time and like when did you find it and how far along and growth rate of tumors and like all these fucking factors that go into how you're able to treat and how effectively you can treat it depending on the cancer.
Molly, is there like when you think of your life and the trajectory of your life, like being personally being somebody who doesn't or hasn't lived with a serious illness, like I kind of think, oh, you know, if everything goes according to plan, I'll die of old age when I'm, you know, 80 or 90 years old. Is that like, is that the storyline that you tell yourself, or is that kind of stained, for lack of a better term, now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm still kind of at a point where I refuse, like I cannot open the floodgates of like thinking about having a recurrence. Because the reality is, with breast cancer recurrence, like my cancer was stage 2B, and you know, stage 4 obviously being like it spread to your other organs. But when people have recurrence of this disease, it's often stage 4. Like it's not a local recurrence, it's a metastatic recurrence. So that would put me in a very different position, and I just like I can't go there.
Right, yeah, right.
So I am choosing to live my life as though I have like a clean bill of health and can move
and
forward.
And you shouldn't go there. Like, because
there's no need.
It doesn't help. Like the way that I look at it is like, it's either going to happen or it's not going to happen, but stressing about it happening isn't going to make it not happen. Yeah. So
we were having this, Brian and I, and you've seen it. I don't know if you said you haven't started watching Black Mirror, but they just released this, this film called Bandersnatch. It's a Black Mirror movie. And the basic premise of the movie is that it's a choose your own adventure. So, there's many, many times in the movie where you're given a choice to go this way or that way, and every decision you make affects the story in a certain way, and you can get looped back to make a different decision. Anyway, plays with this idea of free will and like how we both worry about the past and worry about the future, and how and I turned to Brian and I said, isn't it crazy how many people can obsess over decisions made in the past that then go on and affect their future and how that goes on. And I've never been that person. Like I've always been like, if a decision's made, it's made and I go forward and I never think about it again. Mm-hmm. Like I just can't see the importance of, or the value of obsessing or thinking about changing a decision in the past. And you don't need to go there.
Yeah.
Because like you're not there.
It doesn't serve any purpose.
It doesn't serve any purpose.
It's like the worry flow chart, guys.
Yeah, exactly.
I've talked about it on the podcast before, but Google it if you haven't seen it before.
I feel like now would be a good time to ask a question that we ask most of our guests, which is, out of this entire experience, what would you say is the biggest thing that it has taken away from you?
I mean a lot of things, but to summarize, I guess I would just say like peace. Like there's a certain amount of like blissful ignorance that I think most healthy people walk around with. Like they have like a certain level of, I get like just certainty about how their life is going to unfold, and whether that's realistic or not is a different conversation, but just like knowing that you're going to start a family or, you know, live to be 100 or whatever. And it's taken away that peace from my family as well. And that really weighs on me.
Mm-hmm. What would you say is the biggest thing it's given you?
Perspective. This experience has definitely, it's given me a lot of perspective on what is important to me and what's important in life and, you know, my own priorities. And I'm really grateful to have gained that perspective at the age that I am now, when I still have so long to apply it. I think a lot of people come to that point, but the opportunities are kind of behind them at that point. Yeah. So
that's interesting.
Perspective is, that's a good one.
Yeah.
But don't you think, like, I mean, wavy hair, it's kind of bigger now.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you got wavy hair now.
Maybe in a couple inches, I'll be a little more stoked with the wavy hair. Yeah.
Well, Molly, I want to say thank you for coming in, especially when things
are relatively pretty fresh.
Yeah, very fresh.
You know, like I really admire your ability to come in here and like and put yourself out there in that way of talking about something that you just went through.
Yeah.
And I know that can be really challenging and a bit scary.
Hopefully if there's a lot of people who in your life don't know what you've been through, you can just now direct them to the podcast rather than having to tell them the entire story.
But I think really importantly is that there's probably some people who are in the exact same shoes as you right now.
Yeah.
And are feeling pretty damn grateful that you took this opportunity to come in here. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you guys so much. This is great.
And also just the last thing, this like hits pretty close to home with my mom and her experience and our family's experience. But like the after effects is a really
it's tough real
part to go through. So just make sure that you keep talking about it and.
I've got a link up here on my laptop that I'm going to share with you. I think
I'm actually really happy that you mentioned that because I think people think that it's over for me now and it's behind me. And you know, anyone who's gone through it themselves or has someone close to them who's gone through it knows that that's very much not the
Oftentimes
case.
Oftentimes, the biggest struggle is once you're through it.
This is absolutely harder than the actual like treatment itself. Yeah. But that could be a whole other episode.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you again, Molly.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And thank you all so much for coming in. Thanks for coming into our little zone here and listening. You didn't come in anywhere. You just turned your app on and we thank you for that. And so while you're there, you might as well, hopefully if you're on a laptop, but I think you can do it from your phone, just hit the subscribe button if you haven't already and leave a rating and a review because that would just mean the world to us. It just helps us stay up on the iTunes charts. You know, more people hear these stories, hear these conversations the longer we're up there. And we've been doing it 3 years strong right now, so it feels pretty good. And there's other ways you can support us as well if you think what we're doing is important.
You can go to patreon.com/sickboy and support us there. We have we put that money to very good use. We might be coming to your city for a show.
Especially 2019. We got a lot of fucking places we're going, I think.
We're thinking about hitting a lot of new spots, so stay tuned for that. And it's patreon.com/sickboy.
Mongolia, we're coming for you.
Yeah. Yep.
And if you're wondering why it sounds like we're on a safari, it's because there's just so many mammograms in this episode. Lots of references.
I believe Donovan's dropped in safari sounds. I think you know what, Donovan? Stop. Put me in Mongolia.
Ooh. What does Mongolia sound like?
Oh, it sounds like Wrath of the Khan.
A lot of yurts.
What does that sound like?
Oh, it sounds like old war.
It sounds like leather.
Genghis.
Flaps on
Genghis. Here. Look out. There's Genghis Khan. Oh, wait. He's about to speak. I've never heard him speak before. Let's hear it.
Donovan hates doing this.
Wow.
Are we all descendants of
Genghis Khan? My dad's 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 dad.
I don't know if we'd even go back that far.
I did my 23andMe and got really interesting results. So anyway.
How Mongolian are you?
None.
You don't have any Genghis in you?
No.
Fuck off.
And I don't. So anyway, thanks so much, Donovan. You're amazing. Thank you to Take Part, who did the theme music, but they're also now a new band called Florida Man.
Thanks a lot, Take Part, for confusing us.
And,
Florida Man.
And they've got a band camp. And
they
it's floridamanband.bandcamp.com.
Oh, man, that's a lot of man.
Florida Man Band.
I'm like 98% sure. I'm gonna have to reach out.
Yeah, let's look into that.
Florida Man Band .bandcamp.com.
They actually played us into our live show here in Halifax a couple nights ago, and it was fucking radical. So thank you, Florida Man, the band at bandcamp.com. That is it for this week.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Jeremy.
I'm Molly.
And this is Sick Boy.
Thank you. For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.